pleasure to be here. Thank you. And if I could have about 20 minutes of your time. My name is Donald Swanson. I am an attorney from Omaha with the Coley Jessen Law Firm. We represent an ad hoc group of corn suppliers in the Veresen bankruptcy. And that group has received formal recognition of the bankruptcy as holding an ex officio member or non-voting membership on the official creditors committee in that case. I want to make clear I don't speak for that committee. I only speak for our group. Just a little history on how we got involved in the case. We're in the early stages of the bankruptcy filing. A group of three creditors, three grain suppliers, a couple farmers, and an elevator out in central Nebraska, and another attorney and I embarked upon a strategy to get Trotter Incorporated on the official creditors committee. Trotter has contracts with Veresen of about $6.5 million. He had contracted with them, then he contracted with farmers to buy that corn and sell it to Veresen. Of course, he's honoring his contracts with the farmers, but Veresen is not honoring those contracts going back the other way. So we were able to get him on the official creditors committee. It's a five-seat committee representing all the creditors, but the explicit purpose for having him on there is so that he could speak for the interests of corn suppliers, of farmers, and other elevators. Once that was accomplished, the same group embarked upon an effort to organize a large group of farmers and elevators to represent the interests of those people just generally. And the analogy we used is that in a $1.5 billion case, the individual farmers and elevators would be like a bunch of gnats flying around the debtor and they'd be ignored other than swat them away. And our analogy is what we were trying to do is have some joint and concerted action so it could seem a little more like a wasp, somebody you had to pay attention to and deal with and recognize. And we feel that we've been somewhat successful in that, and we have some goals that we are pursuing. The bankruptcy was filed on October 31. Some details of the bankruptcy, it involves 18 ethanol production facilities across eight states. Early on in the bankruptcy, there were some facilities that went into a hot idle mode, which means they're not producing ethanol. But over the three-month course of that, the other ones followed along, and now my understanding is that there are only a handful of original Veresen facilities that are still operating. The rest are, as I understand it, are in a hot idle mode. Some details about the bankruptcy. You've probably heard the idea that contracts are being rejected. And so you've got a contract with a grain supplier with Veresen for delivery of corn, specific amount of corn at a specific period of time in the future. And the idea of rejection is merely a formal statement by the debtor that the debtor will not honor that contract. It's not typically what's considered, people think when they hear about a rejection of a contract, that it just whoop, goes off into thin air like you hit the delete button on your computer. But that's not what it is at all. It's a statement, formal statement by the debtor that we're not going to honor your contract. That results in a breach of the contract, which under common law, the other party then has a claim for damages. And they can file a proof of claim, hopefully to recover on those damages through the bankruptcy proceeding. You've also probably heard something about potential sales of the Veresen facilities. The public statements by the debtor early on in the case is that they were pursuing that possibility. Subsequent public statements by the debtor seem to be consistent with that. However, I must say that I do not know the details of that, and my presumption is that only Veresen is able to speak authoritatively on that issue right now. One of the events that recently occurred that is a result, we believe, and what we'd like to suggest of our efforts on the committee and that of Mr. Trotter and his counsel is that debtor agreed to have some meetings with the various corn suppliers. And the first installment of those meetings happened this past Wednesday in Omaha, where the debtor, its counsel from Chicago, and the official creditors committee counsel from New York City came and met in Omaha with corn suppliers. There was approximately a couple hundred people in the room. And it was a very forthright exchange of information. The debtor and its representatives started out with about a half hour to 40 minute presentation. and then an hour and a half answering questions. And they were very forthright about that, and we appreciated that very much. And what I'm going to try to do with the few minutes that remain is identify and discuss as faithfully as I can some of the questions and answers that were given in that meeting. The idea is that 3 months into a case, the farmers and the grain elevators have a pretty good handle on what their issues are, and so I'm going to try to communicate those to you. Right now, in this bankruptcy proceeding, the corn suppliers are facing a heightened entrepreneurial risk. Historically, farmers and elevators have always dealt with a volatile grain commodity market, and that's no different here. But once you get into the bankruptcy proceeding, there are new rules and new risks that come along that magnify and multiply those entrepreneurial risks and make some farmers pine for the old days when all you had to worry about was fluctuating commodity prices. I'll put those into three categories, and then I'll conclude. The first category is restrictive language on the back of a check. You may have heard about this where the debtor issued some checks, and the back of it said some complicated language that essentially said, if you sign this, you're agreeing to continue providing corn at market rates like you've always done. What did that mean? If you sign that, are you going to get sued? Does that mean your contract prices are changed? Does that mean you have to deliver more corn than you promised? And most importantly of all, if I don't sign this check now and take the risk of whatever it means, in 2 months, is the debtor going to be there and make good on it? And so it was a terrible dilemma for these people. That dilemma, fortunately, was solved on Wednesday. On Wednesday, the debtor representatives stepped up and very forthrightly and emphatically said that as against corn suppliers, the debtor would not enforce that restrictive language. So if you've already cashed a check, you're all right. If you haven't cashed it, go ahead and cash it. They said if you want a new check without that restriction on the back, bring it in. They'll give you a new check. If you've already cashed it, send them an email. They'll send you back saying they won't enforce it against you. But in any event, that's their commitment, and that was a huge, huge thing to solve that dilemma that existed for quite a while. The second category I want to talk about is the rejection process and the rejection rules. And I suggest that for grain suppliers, farmers, and elevators, it's a rock and a hard place problem. The rock is that people had contracts for delivery in November, December, January, February, March, and on. And under the rejection rules, the debtor can say, Verizon can say, well, you know, those June contracts, we'll wait till maybe May, and we'll tell you then whether we're going to reject it or not. Meanwhile, the supplier doesn't have any corresponding rights to say, I'm not going to honor that. The obligation to honor that contract continues on until the debtor either says, bring it in, or says, I'm going to reject it. Then they can do whatever they want to do with it. But meanwhile, the value, the market and the value of grain is going up and down. And so what happens is the grain supplier loses that opportunity to sell something for a high price. And if the price is going down, they're stuck with the lower price. And to make matters worse, the debtor said, and this is just economic reality, it's no great revelation, the debtor said, we will honor or assume a contract only if market price is higher than the contract. So they're going to hold on, and if your contract is below market, they'll honor your contract. If it is above market, they won't. And so you lose all the way around. Well, what about the prospect of the supplier just saying, look, this plant is in hot idle, the price of grain is way down, and I'll just take the risk. And that's fine. That's a risk you can take. Nobody's going to send you over to jail over it. It's just an economic risk. But the problem is, what happens if it goes up just like it went down? So the supplier is going along. They have a contract out here for delivery. They say, hey, I'm just going to take my lumps now. They sell it at the bottom of the market, perhaps, and then the price goes up, you get down to the contract delivery time, and lo and behold, contract price is below market. All of a sudden, they've got to deliver corn and go out and buy it at a higher price to do it, and so they get hit both ways. Now, of course, the market could do something different, but those are the kind of risks that are heightened risks that are involved in this bankruptcy proceeding. In talking about that fluctuation and the debtor's opportunity to choose when they want to honor or reject contracts, somebody says, you mean you're just cherry picking? You're going out there, and if you're waiting to see what happens, and then you'll pick the contracts that are good for you and reject the ones that are bad for you. And the answer was yes. So somebody says, well, what about the deal where I am, I've got a whole bunch of contracts over a bunch of months, and you reject my first contract? Why doesn't that reject all the contracts? Now, if I go to my bank and I have 10 promissory notes and I default on one of them, they declare them all in default. What about this? The debtor said, no, you can't do that. You got separate contracts. And the argument would be that in your bank documents, there is a provision for cross defaults. There's no such provision in these contracts, so you got to hang on to them, and you've got to take the risk on each one. And that's been a continuing and very difficult problem for these people to face. And again, it's a heightened risk, heightened entrepreneurial risk. The third thing I want to talk about is the notices that went out that we suggest had three bad choices on them. The debtor sent out a notice in December saying, if you act now, there are three choices you have on contracts due in January or before. Not after then, but January and before. So this is in mid-December. They said, you can either, your first choice is to terminate the contract. Well, terminate the contract is similar to what we talked about earlier, this idea that it just evaporates into thin air. That's one of your choices. But if you choose that one, on those contracts from January and prior, you have no right to file a proof of claim. You're waiving that right. So why would you waive that right for the next month's contracts if that's what's going to happen anyway and you have a right to file a proof of claim? It's a bad choice. The second option was to wait on delivery until at least, or until December 31, 2009. In other words, extend the due date on your contract for another year. The problem with that is you got to hold on to your corn for another year under that one, and then the debtor will still only accept the contract if it's below market, so you lose all the way around. And the third option was simply allow the usual rejection rules to apply that we've already talked about. And our judgment is those usual rejection rules are the best of the lot. Of those three choices, you had just doing nothing was your best choice. So when, by way of concluding my presentation here, what our ad hoc group believes as a result of all of this is that these rules and these circumstances as they're applied to corn suppliers are not right and just. At the conclusion of that meeting on Wednesday, it was a very civil meeting. At the end, everybody appreciated the debtor giving us their information. But there is a sense of, when you put it all together, that there is a basic sense of injustice. That putting all the burden on the suppliers and allowing the debtor to do the cherry picking and wait for an extended period of time is not just and right. And so our ad hoc group would request this body of legislators to consider whether anything can be done to minimize those risks in the future. We suggest that anything that could be done would not be easy. It would be a difficult task because there's an interrelationship of a number of laws. You've got your bankruptcy laws that accept and follow some state laws in whole, and there are other laws that the bankruptcy code rejects with impunity. And so if no matter what you do, you've got to figure out where that falls in that scheme. Second, the Uniform Commercial Code, both in Article 2 on sales and the secured transactions, deals thoroughly with all of this, but it's a uniform law for which you want very few state-by-state variations, and so that's something you kind of need to leave alone. And so you're limited to working with other laws. And further, all these laws fit together, and one seemingly minor change in one of them can have ripple effects throughout and a bunch of unintended consequences. So there's a necessity of being very careful and judicious on how you go about doing anything like that. Thank you for your time. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.